welcome inside the Midlife Pilot Podcast. It is your podcast all about flying and aviation in the middle of your life. So the name really tracks, and I think it's pretty on point, if I'm going to be honest about it. I'm Chris Moran. I'm the Midlife Pilot on YouTube, and to my right, your left, as you're watching this, if you're watching this with us live, as we record it every other Wednesday night, 8 p.m. Eastern on YouTube, is my friend and yours, drummer extraordinaire, music producer, filmmaker, drone aficionado, airplane owner, still and again, deep in the heart of Nashville, it's Brian Siskind. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Chris. Boy, that was a solid one right there. You just kind of, I think you've been kind of holding back on some of the superlatives for a while, and then you just, you know, you just delivered.
So I fly every once in a while when I'm feeling generous.
Like when you're introducing me, I think, wow, that guy sounds pretty cool. I'd like to know that guy. He seems to do some cool stuff. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
So yeah, did you notice in the, have you ever noticed, as an audio aficionado, have you ever noticed in the intro music or, you know, sort of synthesizer bit that, and maybe this is just me. I mean, I made it, right? But it's like, it bothers me every time I hear it. One aspect of it, which is that the compressor hits too hard on the first set of chords, and then it kind of you know what I'm talking about.
I do.
The so release. You can hear the attack and release are not quite right. It's actually a defect that I kind of think is kind of a cool sound, but also it kind of bothers me because it's either do that every time or do it none of the time. But when it does it some of the time, and these are the things that, you know, if anybody out there is an audio person, you live your whole life hyperanalyzing all these kinds of things.
It's true. You hear it forever and then you can't unhear it. And then it's the only thing you can hear. And it's a vicious cycle.
Like, yeah. How's the mixing going for your big band project?
It is complete.
Whoa. How many tracks?
It is by the time it was done with all of the like little overdubs and some of the synth parts that I added. I mean, we were
you went back and reinforced it.
There's a little bit of reinforcement. Oh. Yeah. Here's what I promise to those of you who want to talk about flying, we will not, this is not an audio podcast. This is an airplane podcast, but there's things you don't appreciate in a live recording. So like sometimes you need in a band, like this was a wind ensemble, right? So we had a tuba player and we did have a bass guitar player, but like sometimes you just need a little bit more bottom end. What we didn't have was a upright string bass. So I added some of that and we were missing, there were a few parts where we didn't have enough percussionists to play all of the auxiliary percussion stuff, right? Uh-huh. So some of that stuff, it was never my intention to make the performance something it wasn't. It was just, that's what I told people, it was augmenting, not replacing or like trying to fake anything. It was just adding some stuff, but it is complete and probably it was north of 70 or 75 tracks probably by the time it was done. I'll have to show you some screenshots of my Pro Tools session at some point. It was a lot and a ton of automation, you know, just fader moves and
yeah,
it's a lot.
I bet you had I hope that you were using buses.
So many VCA groups and buses for, oh yes. So
we're down the wormhole now. We're going to lose people here. But you know, that's really how the podcast started, was that we were just nerding out about all these kinds of things. So I guess it's fair we do it a little bit, sure. But maybe we talk a little bit about what we're going to talk about, right? Like they always say that, right? For like a presentation, right? Like you tell them what you're going to tell them, then you tell them what you told them.
Right.
So, not that we're telling people, but you know what I'm saying. So Let's maybe talk about, I don't know, what we're going to do tonight. Actually, you know what? Hold on. Disruption. I missed last night the presentation they did here in Nashville on the new Superclass Charlie, expansion of BNA's airspace. They did a big presentation, that I was not able to attend. But I will say, I was very much hoping to get two controllers from BNA to be on the podcast this evening It did not work out. Obviously, they're super busy, but I think it will work out for 2 weeks or in a month from now. So, you know, I'm not saying we're coming for opposing bases or anything, but, you know, we're going to try to bring some controller firepower in here. But really, it's really an interesting dilemma and set of dilemmas that are being sort of solved and or presented by the superclass Charlie. And I think it's BNA is the second busiest class C in the country, I believe. And one more thing about that that I found fascinating, that this is what I want to talk to those folks about, is, you know, the problem is they've got so many aircraft around the area that are not talking to them. And so they want to expand the area and kind of force more people to talk to them. That being said, you know, your initial response or thought is, wow, that's going to, you know, if they're already so bogged down, how are, like, now they're just going to add more.
Right.
But in fact, it's the opposite. And this is what I thought may be the case. And it actually is, which is they burn so much time and calls talking to people to deal with all the people that are not talking, that if everybody was just talking, then
I see
really leaner and easier for them. So it'll be fascinating to sort of see all that sorted out.
What would be great if, John Toon could get radar. That would be nice.
Yeah. But what fun is that? You know, it's sort of like a, you know, I like the idea of, you know, you're coming in there and you don't know what's going to happen.
It would have probably prevented my favorite ever Josh McElhattan radio call of all time. I 360.
No, but Josh, what I think is great about Josh, I know I'm pretty sure you're in the chat right now. What I love about that is that he had that moment. He left it. He's not trying to be too cool for YouTube, right? It was allowed to be on YouTube. And the way that he described it was, what did he say? Like, I just reached into a bag of words and that's what I got, or something like that. You know, that's so good.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. I'm interested in that for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think that'll be really awesome. But anyway, let's get into the, I guess the topic for this evening.
Yeah. I got back from Oshkosh on Sunday.
Yeah.
Man, what a trip that was.
So did you, actually do a count of, root beer floats?
Yeah. Oh, it's disappointing. It's a disappointing number, if you can believe it. I had two. I'll tell you the truth. It was too hot for ice cream. Like, it was one of those things that, like, you know, you get a little too much dairy going and then you're out in 97 degree heat all afternoon. You're like, uh-oh, I've made terrible mistakes. There were a lot of memes. We loved Cecilia. My daughter was with me and she's a social media expert. And so she knows how to find everything about everything on all the platforms. And so she was showing me memes all week of, like, there were a lot of these surviving 120 degree porta potty after eating like 3 days worth of deep fried cheese curds, which is one of the like legendary things they have at Oshkosh. It's like, it was, the heat was definitely a story. Like, it was noticeable and intense for sure. But we were there for 3 days. So we actually modified our plan slightly. We flew to Milwaukee on Southwest Airlines on Wednesday. And the plan was to take our rental vehicle and go, we had an SUV reserve. We were going to go straight to Oshkosh from the airport because we landed at like 12:30 in the afternoon and set up camp and camp at Oshkosh. But thank the Lord, our friend of the podcast, Michael Young, had texted me after our last podcast episode and said, hey, we've got an Airbnb that's like 2 miles from there with an extra bedroom if you guys just want to stay with us. And I was like, yeah, that'd be great. So when we got to the airport, I was fortunate enough to be able to downgrade my car. We just ended up with a smaller sedan then because we didn't need the big vehicle. We ended up staying in Milwaukee on Wednesday and just hung out. We went to the Milwaukee Art Museum, which is
amazing.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I've been there.
So awesome. We spent several hours in there. It was so cool. We just hung out there and stayed at a hotel in downtown, but real historic, hotel in downtown Milwaukee.
Yeah.
And, just kind of chilled. And then, so we drove up on Thursday morning, reasonably early, because we didn't want to waste a day. And I'm not gonna bore you with an hour of talking about the Oshkosh experience, but I'm an overarching theme. And they should be good at it because they've had 70 years. This was the 70th air venture at Oshkosh. So this is 70 years of this show. And they are so good at what they do there in terms of the city as a whole and how they manage the volume of people. I mean, I haven't seen the final numbers, but it's north of like 600,000 attendees. I mean, it's a ridiculous number for a town of that size and for an airport of that size. We didn't sit in traffic, and I kid you not, we drove into parking lots every day. We did not sit in traffic one time coming in and out of Oshkosh to get to the parking lots. It moved the whole way in and out. The shuttle, you know, they're moving people. They're so fit. They know how to do that. Just everything.
How midlife is this? We haven't heard anything about Air Venture. Right? It's sort of like when you're a teenager going to a concert, you don't care about any of this stuff. You're just like, dude, it rocked. Now, how midlife is this, right? You're just like, and I was able to get from here to here. And I never got angry.
The logistics were so amazing to me. Looking at that stuff. I just was so fascinated by how they manage, you know, all of the temporary structures they put up with the portable air conditioning. I was thinking, how much did Sunbelt Rentals make on this show? I mean, I looked, you know, just the volume of portable air conditioning.
Yeah.
You know, just, and the amount of power. Then I'm thinking, oh my God, how much power service do they have at this airport where they can run all this three-phase power everywhere? It's unbelievable, the logistics. And then I was looking at things like, here's something fascinating. Here's aviation-related fascination for you. So I want to go to Oshkosh, the airport, when the show isn't there and walk the grounds again, because, I mean, you won't be able to. I mean, you probably can walk some places, but they do things like you don't notice. Some of the light stanchions that they put up, the actual like lights for people to see the ground, you know, that are along the walkways and stuff, they're on these concrete pads. And I thought, oh my God, they're on these concrete pads because they unbolt these after the show. They can't be here. They're right by a taxiway. This stuff all comes down, and all the taxiway lights that they take out for the show and then put back. I mean, there's so much airport transformation that has to happen to support the show too. It's just remarkable, the logistics of it. But so we got there on Thursday morning, parked, went in the main entrance. I kind of showed Cecilia the lay of the land, because like it came back to me real fast. The layout doesn't change too much year to year. So like I immediately remembered, you know, like, I remember where these exhibit hangers are that I like. I know where the root beer floats are. Like, it's this way to the Warbirds. It's the other way to the ultralight field. You know, it's like, here's where everything is. And so we just kind of walked around and took in all the sights. Somebody I want to have on the podcast is another friend of ours named Colin Chappelle, who works for Joby Aviation.
Yeah. Shout out to Colin.
He hooked us up with a really cool experience. Their company is building a really wild, manned electric VTOL aircraft the end goal here is for personal transportation, air taxi service, basically. Kind of think Uber for the air in major metropolitan areas, at least to start. And they're predicting that when this thing gets commercially adopted and is in use in big cities, that the cost of one of these rides is going to be like equivalent or in the ballpark of just like an Uber Black rate. That this vehicle is so awesome. He let us in. We got the experience, their full simulator thing that wasn't really there for the general public, but we got to spend about 20 minutes or half hour in there with him. Both Cecilia and I got to fly it. And it's the most radical flying experience that I've ever had. You really can't think about it like flying an airplane. This thing is so smart and computer aided, where when you're in the takeoff, you have two controls. You have a right joystick in your right hand here's how it's explained to me. You push it forward if you want to go down, like descend. You pull it backwards if you want to ascend. And you pitch it left or right to like go, like slide left or right, and you can rotate it to control your yaw axis. Okay. And then in your left hand is this throttle, but it's not like a throttle on an airplane. Like, it sits in the middle in a neutral position, and you can push it forward, and if you let go, it comes back to the neutral. And if you pull back, it comes backwards. it is forward and backward, essentially forward and backwards. Okay. When you're in like the takeoff and landing mode that it's in, it's smart enough to control your speed. Like this is much less like you push full forward and it doesn't go fast. It's very detuned and very slow. Landing is super easy. I mean, Cecilia and I both were successfully able to take off and land on a spot. I mean, Cecilia's, I mean, she just sat down and did it like she'd been flying the thing forever. I mean, it was, there's nothing to it. And then when you go in right real mode, you push it forward, you'll establish a speed and you let it go back to neutral and it doesn't slow down. It maintains its speed. But here's the crazy part, guys. Like you can't do anything stupid. Like if you still want to ascend at the speed you're going, you can just pull back on this stick all the way and it'll ascend as fast as it'll let you ascend, but it will not stall or upset or get in a weird, it won't let you, you can't stall it or put it into an attitude that is unsafe at any orientation, at any flight characteristic. You can't, it will not allow you to put it into a mode that is unsafe. So it's like those VTOLs you've seen, like right where the props, they're in one orientation for takeoff and landing, and then some of the props move to a different orientation for forward flight and stuff. Yeah. But it was the coolest thing. And so we'd love to talk to them some more about kind of the design and what they're doing. And there were actually several companies there demonstrating these types of vehicles, but it was pretty wild.
That's amazing. Wild. Do you ever feel sometimes when you see sort of Blade Runner futuristic type things like this sort of coming to life in front of you? I find myself, my first instinct is always, well, that's not going to ever be a thing.
Right.
You know, like how... That's, you can't do that, you know? Right.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And then you realize, well, there's a lot of people betting a lot of money that wouldn't do it unless they had a plan on the return.
Yep, for sure. The air shows were great, as they always are. You know, super entertaining. They don't have, at Oshkosh, they don't have any of the big flight teams there, like the Blue, I think the Blue Angels, like the big multiple jets. And some of that is reasons of where the airport is situated near the town and some other things. There would be some areas they would have to clear of people outside of the airport property to, there's rules, flight line rules for those type of formations for how close they can be to things. And so they don't ever have those big teams, at Oshkosh to do those kind of demonstrations, but the F-22 was there, F-35, F-18, a lot of vintage warbirds. Air shows were really exciting. A lot of the pyrotechnics they use there are the craziest, the explosions on the runway and some of the,
yeah. I mean,
it's
like, you mean like the sort of fake kind of whatever sort of napalmy looking things they're doing? Yeah.
Yeah. We were sad we didn't get to stay for any of the night air shows. And that was mainly just due to the factor that we completely wore ourselves out. In the heat, we were early birds, so we were there, you know, some mornings we were there as early as 7:30, and just by the time the air show starts at 8 p.m you can get out of there till 10 p.m that's a lot of time in the like 90 degree weather, and it was just too much. But the air shows were fantastic. The food was good. I mean, we didn't have any bad food. We tried several different vendors there for food. And
how did Cecilia do? Because I know that she's
she did great. We found, in fact, the very first day we had, there was a Mexican food vendor there that had, vegan chorizo burrito.
Oh, wow.
That was legit. So she had no problem finding, food to eat while we were there. Obviously I mentioned Michael Young. We got to hang out with him and eat lunch. Dave Moscardelli, I think, is in the chat tonight too.
Yeah.
He and his wife Lori were there. So finally got to meet in person and hang out. We walked the Warbird section with them, one of the mornings, and then met a couple other, folks as well. That was pretty cool to put some faces with, names and get to meet up.
What was Cecilia's favorite parts?
I think, she really liked the air shows. I mean, we found a spot by the second day with Michael. The trick was finding places you could see well enough, but in the shade, that was kind of the trick. Like the crazies pack the flight line in the grass, and it's like, there's no shade for a mile in any direction. You're basically, up against the runway essentially. And, we eventually walked up there on Saturday to see we really wanted to see the F-35 and their high speed pass as close as we could get to it. And so we did that one day, but we found a spot in the shade in the vintage section in front of one of the little booths that we staked out the second day. We went an hour before the air show to get our spot. And we basically put our little packs down. We laid in the grass, was propped up with our back and neck so we could see. I mean, it was perfect. We're just like literally laying in the shade in the grass, man, watching the airplanes. Oh man, it was fantastic. She really liked the air shows. I mean, they were really, really good. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, was there ever a point where you just thought, man, I really wish Brian was here?
Oh, yes, all the time. I thought about that more than once.
No, you're like, if Brian was here, he would be, no, he wouldn't care for that too much. I think I'm going to go next year. And, you know, everybody was talking earlier, like, it seems like the way to do it is to let Michael Young lead the way, you know. And for those who don't know, I mean, you know, and Michael Young, he was making some videos early on in his flying. He hasn't done it in a long time, but he is out there on the YouTubes. He did fly with Lou Dix once, but he's been a friend of ours for a while. He came to your midlife pilot fly-in that was at Currituck in the Outer Banks. I think, was that the first time we ever met Michael?
Yes.
Yeah. So cool. Yeah. And then, he came to the Nobody Cares flying in Nashville. And then we went to his hood in St. Simons, and I'm not sure I've ever eaten better or been better taken care of and just led from one thing to the next so effortlessly in my life. So I really do think, that Michael Young, if you're out there, man, we need you, man.
I think there are talks in the works currently for a fall Dayton, Ohio, event, fly-in event.
Really?
So, yeah.
How am I hearing about this now?
Like, well, I meant to tell you before we started tonight. It was actually Dave Moscardelli's idea.
Nice.
That's another kind of centralized place. I mean, definitely for you, me, him,
yeah,
and some of our group, it's reasonably easy to get to. And there's a ton of aviation in Dayton, obviously. I mean, there's a lot of things to do aviation related there.
Yeah.
So hopefully we can get some word out about that and try to plan something where maybe we can meet some more folks who are here. But I did want to say one thing. Anyway, Oshkosh was fantastic. I managed to not get a sunburn, but one of the coolest things I did, and I think you guys will really, this was all about midlife pilots, truthfully. I participated in, some of you may have seen it on social media. The FAA was advertising for, a cognitive study.
Oh, yeah.
That they were going to do at AirVenture this year, and they were paying people. Like, they needed people in the specific age range. I think it was 40 and up. And if you had a first class medical, they were paying $500. If you had a second class, it was $400. And if you had a third class, it was $300 to come and do this computerized cognitive testing. And they did it at the EAA. There's a museum on the ground there, the EAA headquarters and a museum. And they've recently built a beautiful like training facility there with a ton of Redbird simulators and classrooms and conference rooms and stuff. They did it in this training center. And it was so fascinating to me, the kind of data that they were looking at. Like, there was nothing aviation related whatsoever about this test. This was strictly a cognitive ability test where there were events like, they would show you, like, they'd give you a word on screen for 2 seconds each. They'd give you 15 of them and say, try to remember these words. And then way later in the test, it would say, okay, remember those words. Now we're going to show you a list of 70 words. Click the space bar if you recognize one from the list earlier, or press a shift key if you don't.
Oh.
Show up to you for 2 seconds each. So, you know, you just kind of had to go through stuff like that. Or like, they'd give you a little white box that floated around the screen. It would say, keep your mouse cursor in that thing. And below it is a number. And then it says, and click the left mouse button every time the number goes above 56. And so you do that for a while. And then the number would separate from the white square the next time. So you're following the white square over here and the numbers on the other. You know, the point of it all was, and she explained that the doctor, the PhD who was explaining the reasoning for the test, is what they're really looking to establish is a baseline cognitive ability for different age groups of otherwise healthy pilots, so that if they have a person who has, let's say, a stroke, a pilot who has a stroke or a pilot who has some other event, mm-hmm. and they have to test them for cognitive ability, they can say, well, this person at age 62, this is where they fall on the scale of the average of pilots in that age range. So they did this test once back in the late 80s, but so much has changed for, you know, testing methodology. They wanted a new baseline kind of where people were. It was honestly, for an analyst like I am, it was a fascinating study. It took 3.5 hours of time, but you walk out with a $300 MasterCard gift card. That's all we spent the rest of the trip, you know, on food.
Yeah,
and it was, and I really enjoyed it, and I was glad to participate and be kind of part of that. It was really fascinating. Kudos to the FAA. I mean, it was really well done. Every part of it was just expertly done. You could tell they really put a lot of effort into that test. And
wow.
Yeah, it was great.
And did you tank it a little bit on purpose to make it easier for those to come after you?
There was jokes about that in the room, you know, but I was happy. They let us see our scores. Like, they were real strict about, they didn't want distractions in the room. And I tended to finish the segments early, but they wouldn't let anyone walk out and take a break until the whole room was done. So while you were finished, you had these noise canceling headphones on and you could watch the live cams from EAA on the computer. Like, and then at the end, they showed your results. If you finished early enough, they said, you can look at your results if you want on the screen. So I spent some time looking through mine and I was very happy. The comparative results, they had the same study for military personnel in your age group. Mm-hmm. And in just about all the categories, I was in the 98th to 100th percentile, with the exception of short-term and long-term memory. And it was gauged, I was in the average range for my age.
What's left? Midterm memory? Like, what?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how they gauge long-term memory. However they gauge it. But I told my wife I was bummed about my memory score. And she's like, well, I mean, I would think being how you should be for your age is probably the right, you know, the right place to be. And then if on all the other stuff, the math and the reflex time and stuff was good, then I think that's a positive outcome. But it was super cool. I'm glad I did it. Anyway, that was my testing experience. It was very neat.
Fun. Well, it sounds like a great experience all around. You got a good time with your daughter. You got to see a lot of things. Had a couple root beer flows. Didn't overdo it. Didn't get sunburned. So it sounds like it's all a wild success.
Yes, it was very good. Very good.
Do you have any flying coming up or anything?
Potentially. I mean, scheduled flying the end of this month. We're going back to Newport News for, not for work, for my own. I won't say that out loud. We're going to Newport News for pleasure, potentially later this month. And I was trying to fly today, but I'm happy to report our club planes are very busy. And I was going to take 5-2 Lima out for a little bit, but it is, somebody mentioned in the chat, Stinky Weasel's in the chat. He said he's tracking it. It's going to be coming back inbound. So I keep looking over here to the runway because I keep hearing things. I'm expecting to see it come back and land any minute. So it's been flying very, 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 very much, which is good.
Well, I'm going to do now, Chris, what is called a segue.
Oh, wait, we need a wipe transition.
So, I had it all worked out how I was going to smoothly do the segue, but then I just thought maybe there's just too much of a premium on segues. Let's just change the channel.
Go for it.
When it, you know, we've been talking a lot about, the challenges of running a club, the different things that have gone on with the airplanes, a lot of the maintenance concerns and all that. And then meanwhile, you know, I think that you've been a good resource for me, as I'm a newer owner, and trying to sort out fact from fiction and, try to arrive at some sort of baseline, a kind of an MO that you kind of want to establish as an owner about, you know, maintenance. And, you know, for those people that are, you know, doing well enough to where you can just, you know, kind of do whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want it. Maybe it's not as much of a squeeze, but I think that, you know, when you're trying to be as, you know, practical as possible and safe, you know, as a baseline always, but trying to figure out all of that, it's an interesting dynamic. It's the thing that I'm continually fascinated with, I think, is all of the things that you just get absolutely no exposure to, training for, not even a foundational setup other than just like a basic systems understanding and private pilot training. And there's not even I feel like there's almost like a a gulf between, I almost feel like there's some modular thing that you should be able to do as a pilot that is kind of an endorsement or an add-on that is not about becoming an A&P or going down that line, but it's something that kind of funnels or sort of feathers together maybe ownership and pilot, you know, allowable preventive maintenance and, you know, all of that. I feel like there's this kind of massive gulf and you're kind of just left when you get, you just kind of just get out there. And there's a lot of student pilots. You know, we have some in the chat that were student pilots not too long ago that bought planes when they were student pilots, you know, and that's a lot to take on, much less just learning how to fly. And everybody's got to figure this stuff out. So what do people do, right? They go to the internet. That's what we all do to learn things. That's how half of us got here into this position in the first place.
Yep.
There's good and bad for that. But I guess, you know, what I'm finding to be interesting is just that, that sort of interstitial sort of territory between being new and then trying to understand maintenance. And then you've got all these different schools of thought and everybody's got their own outlook. Everybody's got their own mechanic. Everybody's got their own Mike Bush books or everybody's got their own, you know, whatever it is, everybody's got their, these opinions. And a lot of these opinions are not harmonious. They're not universal. They are opinions about something that is the same in terms of, you know, like say a Lycoming engine or whatever, you know? And so I don't know. I just wanted to sort of open up the conversation a little bit around the idea of maintenance and pathways to sort fact from fiction and maintenance. And I can maybe start us off with one example real quick. Like, so I don't know, like we were talking about the hydraulic fluid, right? you know, for the brakes. So you have a little puddle of, you know, fluid under, you know, underneath it's the
right
outside.
You can almost see it.
Oh yeah. So you have, oh, yours is good. Oh, look at that. So yours is not, mine leaks inside the plane.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Well, see, I'd fix that because I don't want to get it on my shoes.
Yeah. So, you know, like this is a problem in my airplane that happened in April when I first got it. And so I was the first person that had really been flying the plane a lot. And so I just thought, well, I've been pressing things a lot and breaking things and or breaking. And so maybe that's just sort of agitated some sort of a connection or something. And it's not that big of a deal, tighten something up. So the mechanic looked at it and, you know, he basically just said, you know, I'm going to tighten some things up and we'll kind of see how it goes, you know? But it's kind of, you know, when you don't know any better, you think brakes important, need brakes. Fluid leaking, more fluid leaks, less brakes. I don't know. How does this work? You know, you kind of understand the system, but it's like, okay, well, there's still fluid there. Can you just top it off? Is it, you know, and so you have to go figure out all these things and you don't want to bug mechanics to death, you know, when you, if you don't have the ability to do that. But you know, at the end of the day, it's like, this is not a safety of flight issue. It's a small thing. And it's kind of like, hey man, if you really want to rip apart or not rip apart, but if you really want to replace the cylinders and the parts and all the things. And, you know, it's just a connection. It's just going to be a lot of manual labor to do, you know, maybe some O-rings. And so, you know, it's kind of, I find myself getting answers from mechanics a lot that are kind of like, I mean, if you really want to do it, we can do it, but I don't think that it's that big of a deal kind of thing. Right. So, you know, what do you think about these kind of things? I mean, how do you sort fact from fiction? How do you sort Mike Bush saying that you should be, you know, you should be leaning when you're taking a shower. You should be leaning when you're eating a burger. You should be, you know, should be leaning while you're doing your taxes. And if you're not fully lean all the time, you know, whatever, like, and then you've got other mechanics that are like, you should, you know, make sure always climb it, you know, take off full rich and
yeah.
You know, all that. So
these are good questions.
Talk to me about it.
I will. So I'll start by saying, I think as an overall idea, there's a few things. Some of this does just come with time, because then the more you fly the same planes, because you do get to know a lot more about your planes, A, just from flying them, but the more you're around working on them and start to understand how the things in them work, a lot of things start to make since the aren't even directly connected. Like, you know, later a thing will come up and you'll say, oh yeah, I remember when this other thing happened. Okay. So I think that's the overarching theme. Now, how do you decide who to trust? We had a really, I'm going to bring this up on here. We, in our Discord, we had a really cool conversation the other day and I loved it, about engine monitors. Okay. Well, just example. No, I'm not going to get into the detail of it. I'm not getting into the details of the conversation. What I'm going to say is, here's a good example, Brian, seriously though, because you know, you brought up, you had a great mechanic who just did some good work on your plane and got some real big problems fixed, who says one thing. And even with the leading thing, you know, and then there's people like Mike Bush, and kind of the argument was like, well, you know, this guy has 50 years of experience. I'm like, well, yeah, so does Mike Bush. So like the years of experience, I don't, it's like anything else. Dan Grider has years of experience, but I won't listen to a word he says.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's a grain of salt kind of a thing. I think the more you fly the specific planes that you fly. And so here's a good example about leaning. You brought that up as an example, so I'll use it. Like, how do you know? So I have always been, A, because my instructor started me this way. Like, the second we start the engine, the very first thing I do after I watch oil pressure come alive, I mean, I'm saying before I even turn on the field switch or whatever in the avionics, the very first thing I do is I pull that red knob as far back as I can pull it. And it's lean at that moment. And some of that comes from what my instructor taught me. Some of it is we have a 150 in this club who I've personally done bore scope inspections of all the cylinders. And then I've also done the same thing on my Cherokee behind me. And you can look at the cylinder walls and the valve, you know, the valves and everything else. And you can very clearly see, what planes have been used for training in full rich environments around the pattern time.
Yeah.
And which ones have been leaned
just by the burn pattern,
how much carbon has built up on all of the insides. I mean, you can very clearly tell a difference. And so I've just been in the mindset of, I lean and climb. Now there's a lot of caveats here. Like, in this plane specifically, because I've got a gigantic engine monitor that monitors every single parameter of every single cylinder. So I have all the tools to like decide, am I safe to lean or not? Like, if I could pull back and climb and then I look over and my cylinder heads are over 400 degrees, I'm like, ooh, I need a little more fuel. You know what I mean? So I have all the tools to make, I'm not advocating that like every pilot in every plane pulls the mixture and climb. Sure. Like, so I think some of it is your own experience with the planes you have, the tools you have at your disposal, and then, you know, just personal experiences. It's like this in every facet of life. You have people that you trust, and sometimes we trust people and they're right about a lot of things, but they might be wrong about some things. But I don't, you know, I just think you get a feel for who kind of aligns with the things that make sense to you and the topics that you've studied and learned about. And, you know, you kind of go with that. I don't know.
Well, the thing that we brought up in the Discord that we were talking about, let's just go right to that for a second. I was just making the point, not that I it's not my position. I was just making the point that I found it interesting that this mechanic that basically was the mechanic that my normal trusted mechanic sent us to for this more kind of specialized fuel system kind of stuff that we needed to get sorted out. And that mechanic said that he was frustrated often, you know, because I asked him, I said, you know, what do you think about engine monitors and engine monitoring in the sense of like in the context of a Cherokee 180, right? That's from the late 60s or whatever, not like any plane, right? And I said, you know, I find it interesting. There's no EGT, there's no CHT. It didn't even come with these things, right? And he's like, exactly. It's a simple machine. And if Piper really thought that those things were necessary, then they would have put those in the plane. It's a fixed pitch propeller. It's a simple engine. The engine will tell you what it needs. That was kind of the mentality. I'm just repeating that, right? Because I find it interesting that you've got on one hand kind of the, you know, send your data to Savvy and have it analyzed and go through all these. There's such an extreme diversion of approaches And his approach was so kind of just fly the plane, you know, just fly the plane. Like just that's, it was very sort of hyper simplified in that way.
Yeah. I mean, And the counterpoint was that I there's a lot of them. I mean, in 1972 or whenever your plane was manufactured, the technology wasn't quite what it is right now to be able to do the kind of things they can do in small spaces with,
of course, yeah,
you know, the monitoring. And I'm a proponent of, I don't think there's ever too much data, mm-hmm. To collect. You can see trends, you can see things before they're problem. But I did appreciate his point. You know, it's like anything else. Like I know I have friends now. I have friends that go to get blood work done
for fun. All the time.
Yeah. I mean, hypersensitive, you know, I think you should get your blood work as the way your doctor orders and how often.
Are they using Blackstone?
They're sending it for the analysis, right? But you know, the idea is like you could freak yourself out continuously when you have that much data at your fingertips. That's a human condition thing more than it is like an aviation engine thing. Like if for no other reason, I like my engine monitor for being able to lean absolutely as efficiently as I can in flight and see every cylinder head temperature every second of the flight. So if I'm anywhere near where I don't want to be, I'll just give it more fuel. I mean,
of course. You know,
that's kind of my general takeaway from my engine monitor. It's my favorite thing with the engine monitor, but I really, I'm anxious to go back through the slides. I wanted so bad to go to Mike Bush's session at Oshkosh on leaning, and I couldn't get to it. I've seen the slides, and I think it's very similar to the one he does online. And you know, and I'm not. He's very logical, and the points he makes make sense to me. I'm not subscribed to his service. I don't upload all my engine monitor data to his. I'm not an all in. You know. Mike Bush guy, but I do think he has a lot of pretty valid takes on a lot of things.
So on that, right? And so, by the way, what this mechanic was telling me was basically, he was just talking about how exhausting it is that people now have I would imagine it's exactly the same as being a doctor now, right? Before, like imagine being a doctor before Google and WebMD and then being a doctor after, right? With WebMD. And you have to spend half of your time trying to talk people down off of whatever they have talked themselves into and used confirmation bias to support whatever narrative that is the most paranoid thing they can come up with or whatever, right? It doesn't mean that getting data is bad. And I think I even mentioned this, like in business, I used to, you know, when I was working at a software company and I'd be in these meetings and they always would say, we need to be data driven. And I'm like, no, we need to be data informed. But we can still use our brains to intuit a lot of the finer points around all this, right? Like, let's not just go down a path blindly. And so I think what he was saying was just that he'll get, you know, on these email threads with people and people come into the shop and they're like, no, I've got to get a, you know, I really think I need it. You know, you're telling me it's like they want to get a new cylinder. He's trying to say like, you know, you don't need a new, it's just this, you know, this is not a literal example, but it's kind of like, no, just this thing's loose. That's all it is. Just, you know, and if you just would have brought it in the first place, I could have saved myself 3 weeks of email threads and phone calls. Mm-hmm. And this was a non-issue, but your data had you all up in arms because you're just looking at downstream effects of something very simple upstream or whatever. I'm not saying that's empirical or a reason to not get data. I'm just saying I can see how from his position that would be kind of a point of, frustration when it's like these are, especially for like a Cherokee or something where it's like, this is a lawnmower engine. This is not, you know, a crazy thing to diagnose. So
sure. It all came back to like the original question was like, you don't need an engine monitor. I said, well, no, you absolutely don't need one. I mean,
you don't need a propeller if you don't,
need an engine monitor. You know, I'm glad that my plane came with all the probes installed in an old one. That was just a pop-in replacement for the big LCD screen. It took 5 minutes. Like I didn't put one in this plane. It had one already. So I'm glad that it did. And, I mean, I thought it was a really good discussion and I think it's, there's certainly valid stuff, all the way around. So to some of your other points, like maintenance items that like we've seen and like, how do you pick the stuff that you're going to like defer to later and keep flying the plane? Like, that's a really good point we talked about a little bit before the podcast. Like, yeah. I was thinking a lot about that. Like, in the club, we've gotten really good at using all the rubber on our tires. You know what I mean? Like, because you could make yourself crazy, like, oh, another flat spot. It's time to change a tire. And I thought, man, if we changed a tire every time we had a flat spot on one of them, we'd be broke. I mean, we definitely run our tires to thread because we just, they fly so much. And so many students, you know, it's just a constant thing. But we've gotten really good at assessing. But here's where I think you get where you make up for that. So like we say, okay, it's time to change this tire on this plane. So when we do it, we take the time every time. Just about, not every time. We don't repack the bearings and stuff every time with grease, but we service parts around it that we're, when we have the wheel off anyway, we say, well, this is a good time to like clean and redo this thing. Or like, you know, it's not just a tire change anymore. And it's always tire and tube. We never screw around. Some people try to reuse tubes, which is, you just don't do that. If you're going to go to all the trouble of pulling it off and deflate, the odds are good that you've almost broken something anyway around the valve stem, and it, you know, you've weakened that. So just change the whole package. And but don't be scared, I guess, don't be scared to run your tires. Like, I mean, a little bit of the tread being gone, you know, and a couple of the grooves on one spot of a couple inches is not a new tire situation. You know, you can defer that a little bit. And we've gotten really good about doing everything we can ourselves. We have a lot of technically, mechanically minded people in the club. So like, I mean, you were talking about hydraulic fluid. You can top the reservoirs yourself as a pilot. Doesn't require an AMP. Obviously the oil stuff, we've gotten really good at changing, not just the filters, but you know, the oil, cleaning the oil screens, which is a pain on a couple of these planes. They're in hard places to get to, and you got to replace a little crush washer every time you do it. But we do that every few oil changes. So every couple hundred hours, change the oil screen, clean the oil screen. I'm trying to think of items that we have chosen to defer. Oh, here's a good one. The primer on this plane behind me has never worked since we bought it. It's only an issue. It's only an issue a couple months a year up here when it gets cold enough to be. We have an engine, we have an oil sump heater, so that helps tremendously. But I had to park it in Charleston, West Virginia overnight in the cold. And I had a real hard time starting. I had to go put it back in a hangar and heat it up for, you know, over an hour to get it to start because I didn't have primer. And so that's been deferred. We have the parts. So at annual, we're going to do it this time. We've just deferred the primer. Yeah. You know, not a huge safety issue. Brakes, you know, how many times have you gotten in a Cessna and been like, boy, this one of these brakes is squishy, you know, it's getting pretty squishy and this one's squishier than the other one. And, we've always felt like as long as you have pressure and can the both wheels can be stopped, you know, it's flyable. So we'll fly it and then service the brakes when it's convenient. Stuff that
land slower.
Yeah, I hope you get your speeds right. You know, stuff that's not obviously deferrable are things like we have one of our planes has an alternator that's in op, so that's obviously that's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. But I just think you get to know your planes, you know, you get to kind of know what, how much is too much, you know, when it's time to, we try not to defer stuff. If we have the time and the money and the ability to do it, we try to do it when we can. But also, if it's a safety issue, because of the volume of people we have flying these planes and the various skill levels, I mean, if it's even remotely, any of us on the board consider it's a safety problem, we'll ground the plane until one of our AMPs can come and look at it and either say for sure. So we've definitely grounded things before. And then somebody came up and said, oh, like we did an oil change. We did an oil change and we always cut the filter open, you know, and pull the elements out and look for metal. And I was all freaked out. I'm like, oh, I don't like the looks of this. So I made an AMP come out. We grounded the plane. I left it laid out on a piece of cardboard in the hangar. And he came up and said, every single piece that you left in there is a carbon deposit. He said, you just got to pick them up and crush them with your fingers. And if they break up, I said, interesting. There was nothing wrong with the engine, but it freaked me out enough that, you know, we grounded it until we were sure.
There's so many things like that, right? You gotta, but it's good. You gotta err to the side of safety and then, you know, be pleasantly surprised when you were an idiot and move on. You know, that's definitely the way to go. Yeah. So does anybody, so what have we covered tonight? We've talked about, it sounds like maybe we're going to do a Dayton thing in the fall. Mm-hmm. And so I like that idea a lot. And so I'm trying to see if we have any other comments or anything in here we want to pull across. There's not really any questions because we've just been kind of yapping.
While you're looking through that, I do want to say that did you talk about, or do you want to talk about your, what your maintenance was? Cause I was going to tell you that what I think what you found, your instinct as to what was going on. I thought you made a very good decision, to have that looked at. You don't have to talk about it if you don't want to, but I just thought your instinct was very, very good.
No, if it's complimentary, I'd like to hear from you more about it, I guess.
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
We'll give the short version, the fuel, engine roughness.
Yeah. So it's a Cherokee 180 Delta model. It's a basically 1968. So in flying this thing, since early April, I've noticed it was newer to me then. I just thought this is kind of just how this plane is. But when I was climbing, you get to about 3,000 feet. If you're full rich on a climb, the engine will start to stumble and kind of shudder. And if you just lean a little bit, you get some RPM back and you just carry on and everything ran great. So I kind of didn't really think it was necessarily that big of a deal. You know, I was flying in the heat in the mountains and, you know, stuff like that. And I just thought, well, yeah, of course you're going to have to lean on the climb or whatever. And I flew it, you know, probably 30 or 35 hours in April. And then when it came up for annual or right around that time, one of the other guys flew it and he experienced that. And for him, having known the plane for a while, but he hadn't flown in a while, but he had, you know, he kind of freaked out like, this is really sketchy. You know, I don't like this. This plane's never done this. He was asking me, you know, I was like, yeah, I mean, it does that, whatever. He's like, no, it should not do this. So long story short, then it goes into annual and the mechanic is saying, I've never seen more carbon, this is a mess kind of thing, you know? And the guys were kind of thinking that I just was just running full rich everywhere all the time or something, like never leaned once ever. And I did not, I did have one instance where I had foul plugs and I knew that like I had been on top of this 100%. So I didn't understand how that was happening. And anyway, it just turns out I was just really running really rich. Our primary mechanic looked at it, and had some thoughts, but, thought it'd be better to send it to his, you know, one of his recommended people, another very experienced mechanic. Took it to him. He found some screws loose in the carburetor, not just with the pilots. And also, so he adjusted the float, tightens up some screws. The fuel pump was OEM 1967. So replaced that and then, did some O-rings on the primer. And it was kind of like, it's going to be, I think what it was definitely one of those, there was definitely fuel getting through, the fuel pump, you know what I mean? Like it was getting around the diaphragm, it was not doing what it was supposed to do. So there was something happening with the fuel pump, something happened with the carburetor and something happened with the primer to some extent all at the same time that amounted to what this issue was. He sorted it all out. I took it up. It was probably 100 degrees outside, 95. And, I just full rich and started spiraling up by the airport, went up, 3,000, definitely would have been having this problem already, 4,000, 5,000, went up to like 6,000 feet. And the density altitude was probably, it was definitely a density altitude kind of day. And then came back down. It was absolutely just no problem whatsoever. And everything's 100% fine. And so now, I can do a full rich climb without an extreme amount of power loss, even in really hot weather. And so that comes back to the whole thing where in the early offing, I thought, well, of course I'm going to be leaning a little bit on takeoff or I'm going to be doing that, and then both of the mechanics that I've been dealing with said, in a Cherokee, you don't, you just, you run full rich on takeoff. I don't care what you say. I don't care what Mike Bush says. I don't care what he says. It's like humming. You run full rich. So,
except in Denver.
Right. If you're at Leadville, it's a different thing. Yeah.
Right.
But you know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
Anyway, it's just a really interesting adventure and sort of getting something. It's so satisfying when you have a problem and then it gets fixed. I don't ever take it for granted, right? It's such a nice feeling when it's like, I have a problem. Sir, will you fix this? And they go, yes, sir, I will fix it for you. And then they do things and then you get it back. And it's like, hey, thank you. It doesn't do that thing anymore. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yep.
That's, I think it is.
Anyway, that was a good, that was an example of a good thing to make you go, this, you know, I should have this looked at.
Yeah.
Where I was flying the 150 and I lost a few hundred RPM while approaching an airport and jammed the throttle in to get it back and then wouldn't touch the throttle again until I was like, knew I could glide to the runway and, you know, everything was fine. And it freaked me out enough that we looked at it too. We took all the spark plugs out and looked through everything. And the conclusion from the mechanic was a lead deposit. That's that plane that has the ton of the deposits.
Gave way, yeah.
Broke loose, held open, got stuck in the opening of an exhaust valve or an intake valve just for a couple cycles of it, and then blew out the exhaust, and then the engine was fine after that, right? So, but it was enough for me that I said, after an engine anomaly like that, someone's going to look at it before it goes in the air again. So those are the kind of things that you say, that's it could potentially be a safety of flight issue. We need to make sure that it's good. So
all that being said, you know, that's the other thing is it's really interesting to fly an airplane to the place that you're going to get it worked on for this issue. You know what I mean? That fine line of like, yeah, it's safe to fly if you're taking it to get fixed.
Right.
Like I don't know. It's just an interesting sort of, it's similar to cars in so many ways in the old, like older cars that I have, you know, where you really have to deal with mechanics and then technicians kind of don't know what to do with it.
Right.
And with these older planes, you know, if you don't have an engine monitor, then you've got to find somebody that can do the wizardry of actually being a mechanic. And really respect it.
It's an art form. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it absolutely is. You learn, you just know how to touch the thing and know what it is and how it should feel and sound and what's the what. And it's definitely an art form. So,
yeah.
Well, this has been fun.
Yeah, man.
Covered a lot of ground.
What should people do?
I'm going to tell you what they should do.
Okay.
I'm going to definitely tell you. I'm also going to say that I think the next few episodes, we have some pretty exciting stuff that we're going to try to work out. I know that you, I definitely want to do the Nashville controllers thing. I'm super fascinated by the airspace changes that are proposed there.
Always happening.
We made some friends with some folks from another aviation podcast out in the Midwest. I think we're going to talk with some folks coming up in a few weeks from there.
Worlds can collide.
We can start to kind of bring some of our groups together there. It should be super fun. Definitely want to talk to the Joby Aviation folks. There'll be some other guests too coming that I haven't even talked to you about yet. But I'm super excited for the next few rounds of episodes. I think we have a lot of good content coming your way. And if you can take a moment to help us out, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the audio podcast. That's a big help, as are especially on Apple reviews and ratings. Every time you rate the podcast or leave a review for us, it really helps the algorithm help our podcast find other people who may find it interesting to join this awesome community that we have started to build around us here. And the more the merrier. So if you can take a minute to help us out with that, it's greatly appreciated.
Yeah.
What else?
No, I think that's it. I will say though, the last thing, Chris, I'm just going to dig on you for a second here. Let's see. I'm ready for the next midlife pilot content, and I've got some stuff coming. I've been so busy with all of the changes and going on in my world that I've got all this stuff written. I've got so many things that are right there. I kind of feel like I'm Chris a little bit right now. I feel like I'm a little bit like you. I've got all this stuff like right there, but I have to get a little free to then start rolling stuff out. But for me, it'll be happening very soon. So thanks for everybody's patience for, and not yelling at me about it as much as I yell at you about yours. Yeah,
for sure. That's fair. I'll take it all the time. Well, thanks for potting tonight. Thanks for all of our friends hanging out in the chat. It was good to see everybody in here tonight. We read all these as they go by. I've been following along with all your conversations tonight. It's always good to see you every other Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on the Midlife Pilot YouTube channel. If you want to hang out and like, be part of the live chat community, it's a whole other animal. You guys that are just listening to the audio podcast don't get to see. There's a it's like a whole nother hour of another show that goes on in the chat amongst themselves. It's very fun to watch. And yeah, thanks for potting, and we'll do it again in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, buddy.
So long, everyone.